The shift from internal combustion to electric vehicles worldwide has been dramatic in the last 20 years. But while that shift has certainly reduced tailpipe emissions in many areas, it has also created a dramatic increase in demand for batteries, lithium-ion batteries in particular. Author Nicholas Niarchos takes us on a journey that explores both the story behind the development of modern battery technology and the supply chain of metals needed to make those batteries in his new book, The Elements of Power, a story of war, technology, and the dirtiest supply chain on earth. We're very lucky to be joined by him this morning. Good morning, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
So, Nick, let me ask you, what motivated you to write the book, and how long did it take to do the research?
Look, I mean, I wanted to write initially about corruption in the Democratic Republic of the Congo's mining industry, focusing on specific individuals. And then I went down there, I realized it was a much, much bigger story. I said, how can the green, renewable energy transition come from this? How can children be digging minerals out of the ground? How can people be looking for cobalt under their houses? How can people be talking about lithium mines in the middle of, Savannah, where it will cost $1 billion to build the road to get there and so on? How can this be the basis of the green transition? And so I think with that very simple question, opened up a whole can of worms. I started reporting the book in earnest in 2019. I'd done a bit of kind of conceptualization before that. And when I say reporting the book, I mean reporting a long form New Yorker piece. And then I sold the book in 21. So it's been kind of almost 5 years in the making.
During the course of the book, you spend a significant amount of time describing the development of electronic battery technology and the different ways that it sprung up in the different countries. Can you sort of lay a little bit of that out? Because I think it's important background.
Yeah, I mean, look, the lithium-ion battery has a fascinating history. It actually was developed at the beginning by Exxon, the oil major, in the 1970s. By a British scientist who was working in the US called Stanley Whittingham. And then that was developed further by another phenomenal scientist in the UK, American scientist in the UK called John Goodenough, and then by a third Japanese scientist, Akira Yoshino. And of course, there are many other people along the way in Japan. And Japan essentially is the place where the lithium-ion battery was first commercialized. Sony took it to the market, and it became very, very popular very, very quickly. It was a way of storing an immense amount of power very, very in a very, very small space, and also quite safely. In terms of recycling, especially because, the existing nickel cadmium technology was very polluting. And so this became really the battery of choice for small device makers, and that kind of intersected with the mobile phone boom. So people were using these devices to power their newfangled cell phones, and that was really what took it to took it from being a niche product that was used to power experimental watches in the 1970s to something that was very much in everybody's household especially by now, but even by the 2010s.
So the lithium ion replaced the NiCad battery.
Yeah, exactly. Essentially, I mean, there were some other batteries. Obviously, lead acid batteries were very popular. There were various different technologies that were kind of in the offing. There was a very early form of sodium ion battery that was being developed by Ford in the 1960s. But these batteries, lithium ion, for various reasons, including just the fact that it was. Just the fact that it was small, it was compact, and it could be quite stable at room temperature. These early sodium ion batteries had to be molten hot to work. So you see how that's beneficial. You don't need an oven in your room to run your cell phone charger or something like that, I guess.
And they also tended not to explode, which I understand was an issue with some of the other technologies.
Yeah, look, lithium-ion battery fires are an issue, and they depend on the battery being kept fairly stable. So if you puncture them, they can be quite dangerous. They can catch on fire. This is plaguing electric vehicle manufacturers. This has plagued electric bike manufacturers and various other different technologies, the Samsung Galaxy S7, used to catch on fire on planes and so on. But generally, it is quite a safe and stable battery technology.
And one of the things that's going to lead us to the other part of our story are the raw materials. What are the key raw materials necessary for the production of the lithium-ion battery?
Yeah, to give you the sort of cookbook ingredients, you have different types of cathode, but essentially the most basic form of lithium-ion battery, which is the one that was first popularized by Sony, have lithium, cobalt, and then they have a graphite anode, and then they'll have an electrolyte across which the ions travel. Of course, that has been developed and refined over time. There are different types. There are ones that use nickel. There are ones that use phosphate and iron, and there are ones that use aluminium and so on, and now there are these sodium-ion batteries which use essentially salt to power them, but they're less powerful than lithium-ion batteries.
And as this technology develops, the Chinese have been pretty aggressive about trying to lead the world in battery production. Can you describe some of the things that they've done?
Yeah, so the Chinese have built... put huge amounts of money into the ground. It is something that we have to recognize. And as the president talks about the U.S. taking the lead in critical minerals refining and production and battery making and so on, you just have to acknowledge that the investment in this field by the Chinese has been immense, and it has been completely outstripped anything that the US has done. And, the US has never really had a real lithium-ion battery manufacturing business. That's not to say that other forms of battery don't exist in the US, and occasionally there are some batteries, the battery materials that are refined in small facilities in the US. By my last count, that was one. The Chinese China is full of these technologies, and it's also been very state mandated. It's been supported by, and I've given examples of how the Bank of China has supported Chinese companies to go out to look for the raw materials. There are examples about how the big battery manufacturers, places like BYD, are very interconnected with the Chinese Communist Party and CATL as well. So it is very much a mission. One mining entrepreneur described it in a speech a couple of years ago as a jihad for the Chinese government to create the battery industry. What is very, very interesting has been also their way of stimulating electric vehicle growth. They have this 10 cities, 10,000 vehicles program that everybody thought was a flop at the beginning. Lo and behold, it has stimulated the highest number of EVs in the world. And, there are places like Chongqing that have more charging stations than the entirety of the UK. So, it's extraordinary the amount of effort that they put into this and how far behind actually the US and other countries are on this very issue.
So one stream of the book is what I would call the demand side, which is this creation of a battery industry. The other stream of the book, of course, is the supply side. Where do those resources come from? And much of the book, you mentioned that the inspiration of the book started with a focus on the Democratic Republic of Congo. Let's talk a little bit about the Congo. First of all, let's talk about how significant are its natural resources with respect to battery technologies.
Well, you can see the significance of the DRC or Congo in the fact that President Trump sat down with the president of Rwanda and the president of Congo on the 4th of December to sign a peace deal that was also a critical metals deal. So what to me is very interesting is that this has become front and center, and the US realizes that it doesn't have the amount of supply that it needs, and the only place that it's going to have supply of cobalt, to some extent lithium, and then all kinds of other things like tantalum, tungsten, tin coming out of the DRC. So that has been a really, really interesting indication of just how important these materials are. But, you know, Congo has sort of been in the middle of automotive and technological developments for well over a century, even though it's one of the poorest, you know, least developed places on Earth in some senses. You have a situation in which, you know, in the 19th century, at the end of the 19th century, rubber was key for tires and the automotive revolution. That was coming from Congo, brutally extracted under the regime of King Leopold II. Then copper, super important today as well, but also for armaments in the First World War, and in the wake of the First World War, the copper mines of Congo were some of the richest, if not the richest, in the world. And then the atomic bomb, you know, the uranium to build the Hiroshima and the Nagasaki bomb comes from a mine that's not too far away from where the cobalt is extracted today. And during the Cold War, cobalt was an important strategic mineral used in weapons design and manufacture. And so now it's just the latest in a long list of things that the world has needed Congo for. But the fact is that no wealth has ever accrued back to the people of Congo. The situation there in many ways is as dire as it was on the eve of decolonization in 1960. Life has not improved for people, and yet huge fortunes have been made. Many of them, in fact, for some of Congo's venal leaders, but also for foreign businessmen. So I think it's an indication of how important these minerals are. The proof is in the pudding, the proof is in the price, and the proof is in the wealth that has been generated from them.
So now, what are the conditions like for those who actually mine the metals, like Odilon, Kalanga?
Yeah, so Odilon Kajumba Kilanga is a artisanal miner. Actually, he's an ex-artisanal miner because he wants to start a restaurant now, and he's tried to leave artisanal mining. He's realized it's a mug's game, as my the people around me would say when I was growing up in the UK. you know that you just work in order to make yourself poorer. I think he said something like that to me once. But he as a young man, his father died. His family was left destitute, and he was told by somebody he could make some money working in artisanal mining. Artisanal mining is a kind of a euphemistic term coined by the mining industry to talk about people who are basically mining by hand, especially in the DRC. Some of those people don't have shoes. Some of those people are children. Some of them are pregnant women washing radioactive ore in streams. And you have to very much separate that from industrial mining, which is done by large firms like Glencore and, you know, some of the large Chinese companies like China Moly, which, you know, they have their own issues, which sort of broadly the issues of mining anywhere in the world. Now that doesn't apply to the governance side, but in terms of artisanal mining, and most of that supply is bought by Chinese companies. Those people are very much on the bottom of the supply chain, and they are working in conditions that are absolutely awful. I mean, I have seen these pits, and they are airless, hot, stifling places that collapse on a regular basis. Nobody should be working there in the 21st century, and children certainly shouldn't be working in them, because they are very, very dangerous places, and going in there is risking your life. So I would say that you are essentially looking at conditions which are akin to those that you would find in some of the worst excesses of mining, coal mining in the 1940s or in the 19th century in the UK or something like that.
Yeah, the term artisanal sounds like fake, you know, sounds like something romantic almost, but it's quite the opposite, it seems.
Yeah, it sounds like you're going to be, you know, artesian water or something like that, but
yeah, exactly.
It's not what it is.
And what percentage of the miners are children?
You know, we really don't know. There's a study which I think is overblown that says something like 360,000. I actually don't think there's a fixed number of those. We can't really say. We don't really know even how many artisanal miners. I mean, we can probably comfortably say that several, 2 million families depend on artisanal mining. So 2 million people depend on artisanal mining in some way, fairly directly. I would say a great many more indirectly. The children, the studies around children have been fairly limited, I would say. Those have been fairly limited. They've extrapolated from a small data set. But the fact is that you see children, when you go to the DRC, you see children on the mines. I've actually been banned from the DRC, so I haven't been there for the past couple of years. But I have contacts there, and they say, look, nothing has changed. You still see children going onto the mines. And I'm in very close contact with, educational institutions there, which try and get children out of mining. And they say that the problem is as bad as ever.
You know, the book contains a story about how you were banned, including a period of time when you were detained. Can you share a little bit about why you were detained and what the implications are?
Yeah, so I was detained for pretty unclear reasons. I was accused of espionage, and this was a situation in which I was trying to interview people close to a militia group. That group, is. I was trying to interview people close to this militia group and trying to understand. I had been told a story about people making money from artisanal mining and funneling it towards separatist groups. And I thought that the possibility that your iPhone contains a piece of metal that is funding a anti-state militia group, which is accused of cannibalism and all kinds of things like that, that possibility made it worth looking into. So I followed that lead. It turned out that I was being set up. Now, why I was being set up is a big question, and I don't think it's answered really at the moment. One theory was that in a sort of different line of inquiry, I was looking at connections between the presidential family and artisanal mining. Somebody had told me about that and was demanding money, and then I said to them, look, maybe... I said, look, as a journalist, I can't pay you anything. And he said, look, you're going to regret this. So I think that might have been one of the things, because I was questioned about that interaction in detail during my interrogations. I also believe that Secretary of State Blinken under the last administration was coming for a trade negotiation with the DRC. And there is a theory in Washington that I was being held as a form of leverage. And to their great credit, the State Department did everything that they could to get me out of that situation. And also Representative Chris Smith of New Jersey and several other people on Capitol Hill, people who are very, very involved and engaged with the Congo question. So I think that the circumstances of my detention, which was, essentially I was taken to this sort of, might call it a sort of black site. And then I was shipped across the country. I was upbraided repeatedly by the head of the secret police. So it was sort of as if, the head of the CIA was interviewing me about my reporting, which made me feel like there was something of significance that I was looking into. But what that thing was fairly unclear to me. And, there's a very good piece out in The Economist by a brilliant Congo journalist. I think it's out in this week's Economist or last week's Economist. It's talking about the arrests happening in Congo. I feel like the government is very shaky ground. They feel very uncertain about their future. And this basically has its root in corruption and people being completely fed up with the level of corruption happening in the DRC.
There are many other stories in the book about successive waves of governments and corruption. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. We've been speaking with author Nick Niarchos about his book, The Elements of Power, A Story of War, Technology, and the Dirtiest Supply Chain on Earth. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
It was great being with you.
We'll be right back after this.